It was amazing to be able to sell a business for such an amount. I think it's still the largest edtech exit in Europe. We had some sort of mass resignations going on where I do remember people went, you know, for lunch and they came back, and out of these five people who went for lunch, four handed in their resignation because, you know, like, look, this business has no future and we don't like you as a CEO anyways, and I don't like working on this old technology, so we are out of here. And then the next day, these four people went for lunch with another five people, and I again had like a bunch of resignations. So we went from 50 back to 10 within a couple of weeks. So nearly the entire tech team. And then there was a point in which I felt, look, we need to stop that. And everyone who just is on now resignation or notice period or just working off their last few weeks, you can stop working immediately. Just get out of the business. And in that moment, when I was sitting by myself in this dark, shiny new offices where everyone had left, that definitely was one of the darkest moments I had at Boozoo, because I was working 7 years into that and nearly saw everything I ever built falling apart in front of me. I also swore to myself that if I'm able to do this again, which I was thanks to the investment, I want to build a completely different organization. I want to build a business that is really culture-driven, with people that are aligned, that love working here, that really enjoy coming to the office. And that's what I did.
Welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
I get all of my guests to introduce themselves. Mm-hmm. So what should our audience know about the one and only Bernhard?
Yeah, so my name is Bernhard Niesner. I'm originally from Austria, I'm from Vienna. I'm about to turn 46 years old.
And spring chicken.
Yeah, kind of. I'm the co-founder and now ex-CEO of Boozoo, which is an online language learning platform that I co-founded in the year 2008. And I ran it for about 15 years and sold it by the end of 21. Stayed on for a little bit and then left operationally midst of 23. And since then, I've been enjoying my time out.
When you started, did you have the expectation that you were going to be in the startup game for 15 years or in a single startup for 15 years?
Absolutely not. I founded the business out of doing an MBA at IE Business School in Madrid, which is one of the Europe's top business schools. I actually was before in strategy consulting, but got a bit bored of just recommending other people what to do and wanted rather to do it myself. And IE was very much focused on entrepreneurship, so that's why I chose the school. And there I met my co-founder, Adrian, who had the original idea of Boozoo, and he was looking for a team and I was looking for an idea, and we just met at a random networking event, sat next to each other. And I always had a big passion for learning languages. I studied international business, but actually the subjects I enjoyed the most was learning Spanish and then Portuguese. I lived in Latin America a bit and I realized how learning other languages can really open your own perspective on other cultures, etc. So I was immediately drawn to this idea of creating an online platform for language learning. And that's what we then did. But to come back to your question, I think being an MBA student at that time, you have this fantasy of doing a startup, raising money, and then selling it off to Google a couple of years later. Obviously, that didn't happen, but I'm glad it didn't.
Why are you glad it didn't?
Because it would have been a shame to miss out on all the journey and all the learnings and the roller coaster that I had. It was an intense and at times very tough time in my life, but I'm so happy that I had the chance and opportunity to go through all of that, because it made me the person that I am today.
Okay, so 15-year journey, which shaped who you are today, and out of the gates, you start a company which you then go on to sell for over $430 million 15 years later, having raised only $16 million.
Yes.
Now, we'll go into the fundraising and exit process, but the story of yours that I connected with when we first met was this culture crisis moment that you had in 2013, 2014. Can you speak to the backstory of where the company almost died.
Yeah. And it was only one of the moments the company almost died.
Perfect. We'll save the other ones later.
There are a few others. Yeah. But that was probably one of the most decisive moments in the history of Boozoo. So as said, we launched in 2008. At that time, little did we know that a couple of months later, the Lehman Brothers crisis would come. So financial crisis in Europe. We actually started the business in Madrid, in Spain, because we somehow, you know, didn't really think too much about the best place to launch a startup in Europe. We loved Spain. We were studying there anyways. We had our flats. We just stayed there in a very tiny room. In fact, I think we used our student passes for the first 6 months, who somehow were not turned off, to get access to the university. And we're just working out of the study rooms there until someone realized and turned them off. So we had to find an office. And then we got kicked out, kind of. And then we started in Madrid in a very tiny place. But because the financial crisis hit Europe quite hard, it was also impossible to raise any money. So whereas at the beginning we thought, okay, we just go out and raise money from a VC or business angels, that just didn't work out. So we bootstrapped for over 2 years, which also meant that, you know, I didn't have a salary for 2 years. We were eating very tiny tapas in Spain and kept everything on a kind of low flame, hired just a couple of people at that time. But when the crisis actually hit Spain even more so, there was mass unemployment, the whole, I think, environment, ecosystem was very complicated. It was somehow very difficult to find good engineers, because at that time, you know, working in a startup was not very common in Spain. There was not really an ecosystem as such. So we decided to move the entire business from Madrid to London, which at that time, and probably still is, was kind of the epicenter of the startup scene. So We offered all our employees to come with us, and everyone except one person joined us. We were about 10 people at the time. So we had a big moving van with 200 moving boxes and literally moved all of these people, including their lives, from Madrid to London, and then set up the shop here in the city. During the time also, we raised some money from a venture capitalist, ProFounders Capital. We also had a bit of family money from my co-founder during the time. So because we had that money at hand and we were now in London and we wanted really to scale up, we did what you do when you raise money, which is to start hiring quite quickly. At that time, actually, I think we had already a pretty good culture in the business. We were a very close-knit team. It was kind of the Spanish team, even though also there were a lot of international people, but we were like a perfectly, I think, well-aligned team at the time. But we started to add a lot of people on top. So we were 10, and I think we grew to 50 in a couple of months. So I think I was quite ignorant and naive, and because he had all these very friendly headhunters that were, you know, suggesting all sorts of different people that they could put forward. And after maybe only one or two interviews, we made offers quite quickly. We also got new offices, shiny new offices around the then, you know, old street Silicon Roundabout, directly there in the heart of the startup scene. So beautiful new offices. So we kind of started to ramp up and filled these seats with a lot of people. There was also the issue that because we launched in 2008, we initially launched as a website business, because the iPhone has not really been launched. The App Store didn't really exist. That came, I think, 12 months later. So our entire tech infrastructure was based on an old web stack, which at that time was actually a Drupal content management system. And we had already, I think, 10, 15, 20 million users at the time. We were growing fast, but we're literally riding on this totally outdated technology. And at the same time, realized that we need to transition into a mobile-first business, because somehow learning a language is something you need to do continuously. And people started to get their mobile phones, and they were no longer just sitting at home in front of a laptop, but rather, you know, we wanted it to be something that you can do snack bite and do constantly when you're on the go. So we realized that we need to shift towards a mobile-first business, but that also meant that we had to completely change our entire tech infrastructure. We basically had to take a sledgehammer, hammer down the entire building that we had built now for already 7 years, and rebuild it completely from scratch. And that was painful. And for that, we needed to hire a lot of engineers. But the engineers that joined us, they were like, you know, what the heck? I don't want to work with this like legacy technology, this freaking Drupal, whatever 3.0, whatever you had there. I want to build a completely new, shiny, and use new technologies, not trying to transition this old business into the new world. So there was also a lot of resistance, I think, from the engineers. And because we probably were not super transparent, or we were not very explicit about that in the hiring system, there was a lot of, I think, misalignment between what people expected to do, what they were actually asked to do. And so we didn't really look for the right culture fit. And that led us to nearly hit the wall. So because we were stuck into this replatforming, which my CTO at the time, he initially said it will roughly take us 3 months to do so. At the end of the day, it took us 2 years to get completely out of that. So we were paralyzed in this replatforming for 2 years, couldn't really run or launch new features. And therefore, our revenue started to decline because the entire rest of the ecosystem started to go mobile first. So the revenue started to decline. We didn't really improve the product much. We were stuck in the mud. We had to pay back this technical debt. And so we were running out of money. And then there was a fundraise that we were about to do with an Austrian investor. But somehow it fell through. So we had only a couple of months cash left in the bank. And so we had to do some redundancies. We had to make cuts to the team, and we decided to, unfortunately, lay off about 10 people at the time to go from 50 to 40. But because the rest of the team was not really aligned with the business anyway and did not really like working on this legacy technology, a lot of people actually became quite grumpy and probably rightly so, also annoyed about the situation that we were in. And I also learned that, you know, whenever you make people redundant and some people want to move on, it's much better to actually take them out from the business immediately rather than having them work their notice period, because it turned into quite a toxic and negative environment. So we had a few people that were quite, let's say, negative about the business as such, and they decided to create an environment to convince other people that actually Boozoo really as a business is not the place they should work. So we had some sort of mass resignations going on, where I do remember people went, you know, for lunch and they came back, and out of these 5 people who went for lunch, 4 handed in their resignation because they were like, look, this business has no future and we don't like you as a CEO anyways, and I don't like working on this shitty old technology, so we are out of here. And then the next day, these 4 people went for lunch with another 5 people, and I again had like a bunch of resignations on my table. And that was painful because we felt, no, we have a plan. You know, we are about to launch this new mobile app. Things are going to get better. But they couldn't really see it. Definitely didn't trust in my opinion, because, you know, we already hit the bump in the road. So within a couple of weeks, we lost another 30 people of the team. So we went from 50 back to 10. Within a couple of weeks. So nearly the entire tech team resigned. And then there was a point in which I felt, look, we need to stop that. And everyone who just is on now resignation or notice period or just working off their last few weeks, just get out of the business. Like, you know, you can stop working immediately. Just leave your laptop, get out. And I probably should have done that a couple of weeks earlier, but we had basically lost already most of them. With the interesting benefit to the situation that because we had lost so many people, suddenly we turned cash flow positive because, you know, our payments, salary payments went drastically down. And then I took the remaining 10 people that I felt I could kind of, you know, trust upon, and the ones who are still in that journey, and we went all to Madrid on an offsite, and, you know, had a bit of a party and a moment together, and it helped us to kind of galvanize this team together and said, okay, look, we hit ground now, but actually we are about to launch this new product, and then we had to hire urgently an agency to take over from just a technical perspective, because someone had to steer the bus, because we were already doing multi-million revenues at the time. We had users coming in, and we had, I don't know, hardly any engineers left to take care of the system. So we hired an external agency actually in Spain that we could trust, and they took over for the time being. And interestingly, a couple of weeks later, we got approached by McGraw Hill Education, a big publisher from the US, and they wanted to invest into the business. So then we went through a pretty quick due diligence, and a couple of weeks later, not only did we launch the mobile version of Boozoo, which turned out to work really well and our numbers started to pick up again, but also we suddenly had 6 million euros in the bank because we closed this fundraise. So just one example of this crazy roller coaster from near death, running out of money, losing the entire team, to kind of being the hero on TechCrunch of raising 6 million euros, from a big publisher, and all our numbers starting to grow again. And in that moment, when I was kind of probably sitting by myself in this dark, shiny new offices where everyone had left, that definitely was one of the darkest moments I had at Boozoo, because already I was working 7 years into that and nearly saw everything I ever built falling apart in front of me. I also swore to myself that, you know, if I'm able to do this again, which I was thanks to the investment, I want to build a completely different organization. I want to build a business that is really culture-driven, with people that are aligned, that love working here, that really enjoy coming to the office. And that's what I did. I actually, with the help of an external consultant, we did a lot of thoughts into how to build a culture first business. And, we then started to properly define our values, which I believe, you need to do as a founder, because it's something that's very close to your own heart, and you need to build something that actually you enjoy coming to work and to that place every day. And we then did workshops with the team, and we defined, the core values. But then most importantly, we operationalized through so-called actionable behaviors. And that then really helped us to build a highly aligned team, which brought us to our success up to when we were about 200 people.
Wow. So many elements of that story I'd love to dive into. But let's stay on the culture train. Can you take us through any really impactful exercises that you did with these external consultants when you brought them in?
Yeah. So I think definitely the first lesson is that the core values of the business need to be defined by the founding team. And at that time, my co-founder had already left the business. He decided to move on. So it was kind of myself. And I think I really sat down and thought, okay, what are the values that are close to my heart? And these values, I think they're even still with the business up until now, even after the acquisition. It's the teach values. It's trust, effectiveness, ambition, curiosity, and happiness. And I would say that if I were to ask Boozoo people or employees, ex-employees today, even at 4 a.m. in the morning, and I would ask them what are the core values of Boozoo, they would be able to recite those, because we were so much talking about it, but so, I think, ingraining these values into the day-to-day operations. But the values, trust or effectiveness or ambition, mean a lot of different things to different people. It's very blurry. It's a typical thing that people put on a poster in the kitchen next to the ping pong table, but it doesn't mean anything. So I think the biggest learning really is, culture for me is, values times behaviors. It's really like, what people do when no one is looking. So you want to act people upon certain values, because everyone takes thousands of micro decisions every day when they are working, how to write these emails, how to talk in a one-on-one with this person, how to behave in an offsite or whatever it might be. All of these are, thousands of decisions that people take. And ideally, you have alignment among the team, how success looks like. What's actually our definition of ambition? What does that actually mean? Or how do we foster curiosity within the organization? So we operationalized these values. Each of them had so-called actionable behaviors: celebrate the team, or go the extra mile, or become the best version of yourself in terms of curiosity, for example. That we try to really explain, what does it mean to be curious? And that we did together with external consultants, where we then also, I guess, had the team involved. We did one big offsite in Croatia where we hired an entire island and took, I think at that time, about 100 people to that island and really, I think, explained again the values and the behaviors to the team, but also got their input, and there was refinement of some of these values, because also it's a living organization, a business, and that's why it needs to evolve. Whatever works with 20 people doesn't work with 50 and doesn't work beyond the 100 people. So I think there was obviously some sort of participation of the team to make sure that everyone is also on board with that.
So before we jump from the 10 to 100 people, yeah, that middle phase, which I feel where probably most of our audience are in within that phase, you boiled the team down to 10 core people that you could trust.
Yeah.
You went on this offsite, you celebrated, you galvanized the team again. Then you realized that you had to rebuild it, a culture-first organization from the ground up. I'm assuming you brought in the external consultants around that time.
Yeah, probably a couple of months later. Yes, exactly. When we start hiring again. Yes, because I knew, I mean, what I definitely couldn't do, that would be madness, start hiring again. And, just get the people in and then hit the bump in the road a couple of months later. So I wanted to really make sure that this time I get people on board that are also aligned with, you know, my vision for the business and the way I think we should do things together. So I knew that the next, let's say, generation of leadership, because also I had lost nearly my entire leadership at that time, I knew that the next leaders of the business that I need to bring in, we really need to be aligned.
And so then now that you're out of the business and you're thinking about potential other businesses that you might start at some point in the future, would you have all of this laid out and figured out before you start the next business? Or is this a sort of, once you have 5-10 people, at what point does this become important foundations to lay?
I think you cannot start early enough with that. I mean, culture eats a strategy for breakfast, you know, the old saying of Peter Drucker. I've seen it over and over again. And therefore, I mean, now I invest into businesses. I've invested in over 25 businesses at this point. And it's interesting actually how still very few of them think culture first. And they think more about fundraising and they think about, you know, sales and go to market and you name it. That's all important. But actually, culture still will eat the strategy if you don't get it right. And therefore, it's so important to be explicit about that from the beginning. Your culture can evolve and it should evolve. But still, it's the fundament of the organization. And that's why it's so important to be clear about that and to be transparent. Because then you're also going to attract the right type of people for the various different stages of the journey. So even if you're only 5, I think it's very important to be explicit about what the core values are, what the behaviors you expect based on these core values, and then you set the tone. And then these people will, when you grow, start to hire other people. And, you know, then again, you have a baseline that other people can look up to and say, ah, that's the way we run meetings here. That's how we talk in our performance reviews. And I think with most of the people, it just unfortunately stops in the maybe articulation of values, but then they don't operationalize that. And that is, I think, where we made a difference by really thinking through that from the entire life cycle of, let's say, the employees, for example. So from how we write a job ad, of how we make sure that job ads incorporate the type of values that we are looking for and behaviors that we're looking for, to the interview process, where for each of the, you know, actionable behaviors, we defined core interview questions and certain answers that we would expect, or let's say answers that we rate good and answers that we don't rate so well in an interview question, to probation period, for example. So we were quite strict on our probation period. It was always 3 months or 6 months for a senior leadership team. And after the 3 months, if not nearly the entire team is thumbs up, we would not pass probation. And at a certain point, you know, we probably had between 20 and 25% of people not passing probation. And you could say it's a failure. I would say it's actually a good thing because you set the bar incredibly high. And we all know it's much more expensive to fire someone a year in than to let them go 3 months into the probation, because most likely not even that person is going to have a good time in the organization because they will realize that they actually don't really fit to the core values because it's something so ingrained within yourself. Let's say ambition. If you are a highly ambitious organization, you want to build a high performing team, you might not want people in the organization who believe they need to shut down the computer at 6 p.m. sharp and that's it. And they will never do anything beyond that because somehow that's how they operate. They will not strive in an organization where actually what matters your time or the work that you put in is based on the requirements, whatever is needed. And if, you know, sometimes it's up until 10 p.m., potentially it might also be needed, but maybe next day you do only half day, whatever it can be, but it cannot be just based on some time. It needs to be based on the output that you need to produce at that time. And therefore, if you're not the type of person who loves doing that, who is ambitious and wants to, you know, push your own boundaries, then probably you're just in the wrong place. And you spend so much, I mean, I don't know, 80% of your awake time in a freaking office or in front of a computer at home working for an organization, that if that is not aligned with your core values, then you shouldn't be there in the first place. It's just a waste of your time and it's a waste of the time of the organization as well. So that's why the more explicit you are in, let's say, interview process, probation pass, then we went on in terms of, let's say, performance reviews. Our quarterly performance reviews, there was an element of pure, let's say, quantitative performance, whatever you're in sales or product or whatever the KPIs might be. But then big part of also your compensation and bonus was based on value fit and how you actually adhered to the actionable behavior. So you would need to rate yourself also how you fit to these behaviors. Give me examples of how, you know, you became the best version of yourselves. Well, what have you learned during the last quarter, or how you celebrated the team, how you supported others to be successful, and all of that we had. And, you know, if there were maybe two quarters in a row where that didn't really work out from a performance evaluation perspective, you most likely should also leave the organization. So you can call it tough, but then equally it allowed us to create such a team, such an organization where literally you would come in and, you know, people also refer to culture as the smell of the place. Like you go in, and at that time it was pre-COVID, so people were still in the office, but you could just see this engagement, this fun, like people like working together on difficult problems. It was a great place to be, and people wanted to be there and wanted to push themselves. And, you know, after the exit, obviously a lot of people made a lot of money, but these people also have gone back into creating other businesses and being incredibly successful. So I think also Booz at a certain point became a big hunting ground for other tech startups because they knew it's an A team that you can get access to there because people just are trained in a certain way, and people who come from Boozoo will most likely be successful in other organizations as well.
You said that the founder or the founding team should set the values, mm-hmm. and the team should talk about the actionable behaviors right. within yeah. each of those values.
Right.
When you set the values, which I think you said was by yourself
yeah.
when you were at 10 people, given that that was the first time you drew that line in the sand,
yeah.
was that then a point of friction in the team where some people go, actually, I don't align with two of your five values, therefore they naturally churn?
Yeah, I think, in fact, it might have been that even I started that process when this kind of mass resignation happened. And I remember there was some sort of team offsite that we did, you know, where I think I presented or we discussed about the core values, and some people were like, no, but I'm not aligned to that. Like, you know, I want to go home at 6 p.m. sharp. I have no interest in doing more, even though we are in the midst of a crisis and the, you know, whole company might explode if we don't put some extra time in. And they just then decided to leave. So I think that line in the sand actually very much aligned with this exodus that we had. But equally, I wasn't comfortable with saying, you know what, actually, maybe we should just take a notch back and like be a bit more relaxed about it because, you know, I'm a highly ambitious person myself. I love to, you know, give 150, 200%. And let's face it, if shit hits the fan, you know, you need to do sometimes extra, go the extra mile. And therefore, I wasn't really comfortable with creating an organization that wouldn't adhere to that. And I think that's just important because as an entrepreneur already, you have so much freedom and the obligation to create actually a business where you personally strive as well. And people operate in a different way. And, you know, I, maybe also because of my background in strategy consulting, like there you learn to work incredibly hard. And I'm not saying it's always about working hard. It's a combination of working hard and smart. But I haven't met a single and successful entrepreneur who has not worked hard. I think it doesn't exist. It's a myth. So, you know, my recipe for success, something is, okay, you just need to put the extra hours in, and whether it's, you know, over the weekend or whatever it might be. And therefore, that's my modus operandi. Therefore, my organization will most likely lose the work that way. If you're a different type of person, you have other strengths maybe, then you need to create an organization around your own values. But don't create an organization where you have values that are not aligned with yourself, because it just naturally is going to lead to friction. And that's why I think, yeah, it needs to come from the founding team. It needs to be something. Ideally, you know, it's only a couple of values, so people also remember them. I think acronyms really work incredibly well, because ideally it's really something that you can constantly talk about, and you know, people remember themselves. And then the behaviors, I think there is where it's about the interpretation of what it actually means. And of course, there is some sort of flexibility in there, because it needs to work also maybe with the team that you currently have. There's incredible inputs that come because people have different perspectives, but the baseline just needs to be aligned. And I think there is sometimes where, you know, people confuse diversity with cultural alignment. Like, I do think, of course, diverse teams perform, and it's proven, much better than, you know, non-diverse teams. But I couldn't care less about religion, gender, orientation, you name it. We need to have a diverse team as such, but we need to have cultural alignment. So I think that is very important, that I don't think a team will be successful by having three different definitions of ambition or three different definitions of how a good teamwork should look like. That diversity doesn't work. It will be, and you see it in best performing sports teams. I mean, players among Real Madrid or whatever top football team you might pick, there's very clear alignment, you know, in terms of ambition level and what you want to do. There's no discussion about that, what they want to achieve. They all come from all sorts of different backgrounds and so on. That's amazing. That's why they play so incredibly well. But the core values, there just needs to be a clear understanding that we are all on the same page.
So going back to this ambition value specifically, Hansi, your first angel investor, who I had a wonderful conversation with before, he described you as quite a perfectionist at the start, and said that you, to some degree, expected perfection from other people as well. And you held other people to a similar standard that you held yourself at, which sounds in line with this ambition value. To what extent does that work in terms of, you know, that you will push yourself 150, 200%? To what extent can you demand that same level from employees?
I think you need to demand it as much as you can, and you need to set the right standard. But there comes a point where maybe perfectionism is also the enemy of getting things done, right? So, and I believe I have learned my journey in that. I probably also was a pretty much a micromanager at the early years of Boozoo, but then also learned to let go, because I trusted people much more. So doing things just perfect doesn't really scale. And you just need to let go and rather focus on getting shit done, which, you know, was also one of our core actionable behaviors, than just doing everything perfect. But still, I do believe, you know, you need to provide an environment for people to strive, because the best employees, they just constantly want to improve and get better. And if you don't provide that, where it's just okay to do 80% and to hand in a presentation and, you know, not be really prepared in meetings and no one taking notes and there's no actions and so on, the best people will leave. Like, it's not an environment where you attract top talent, but you need the top talent for you as a company to succeed. But it doesn't mean it needs to be perfect. I think obviously then people bring their own perspectives in and have, but at least the main kind of bar needs to be incredibly high, but it doesn't need to be 100% perfect all the time.
I heard Brian Chesky speak about this recently, where he was talking about how he's still very much in the details of the company.
Yeah.
He says, as the leader, you need, and Airbnb is thousands and thousands of people, right? But he still feels like he's very much in the details, and lots of decisions still have to go through him. How do you balance, what's the difference between micromanaging but still being in the details as a leader?
Yeah, I would say, especially in the early days, some sort of micromanagement might even be useful because, first of all, I do believe as a founder, you need to be able to understand nearly all of the jobs that are being done in an organization. I'm not an engineer, so I'm not being able to look at the code, but at least I need to have some rough understanding of how it works. And then you hire the top talent to actually take care of that. But I probably was the first salesperson. I definitely was the first salesperson at Boozoo when we sold to organizations. I was owning product and I literally wireframed the entire product myself on a PowerPoint and, handed it over to Adrian at the time and he was coding it into the platform. So for example, obsession about the customer, the user journey is incredibly important because if you're too hands-off and you don't care about the core elements of the business, what are you then even doing as a CEO or founder? So of course you need to care. And I think to show that level of care is also a great example for other people in the business. Because if you don't care of how the onboarding process works in an app, and it's a bit clunky and shitty, then, you're doing something wrong. If you don't care of, how the B2B customers are happy with the, whole product experience, then what are you doing? So I do think these like core elements, you just need to care and make sure that other people then care. And ideally then, of course, after some time when you have the money as well, you hire people who are much better at these roles anyways. Of course, the other night I was lucky to hire amazing CTOs, amazing head of product. They were much better in product than myself. Then I can, let go and maybe focus on more on the vision. But equally, I always love to, keep them on their toes. And, I would sign up again, through the onboarding process, I would use the app or I would look at the presentations and so on, just to make sure that we all hold ourselves accountable to a high standard of performance. Because with that, if we understand, and there I believe, a company is not a family. And people, I think, sometimes confuse that. It's not, maybe did say Boozoo family at points, but I think that's the wrong word. It's a high-performing team. It's a high-performing team where you need to hold yourself accountable for great performance because if you have someone not performing well, it might risk the entire organization. And that's where you really attract and keep great leaders because they might start, and I had that so often. I had people start in customer service answering emails from people to reset their passwords, and then they transitioned into becoming senior engineers after a couple of years because we allowed them to strive. Because it was an organization that just pushed people hard, so to say, to become the best version of themselves. But there were no boundaries. They could just progress. And that's, I think, it's the best talent magnet strategy.
So then speaking to attracting top talent when you have a high-performing team of A players, did most of your top talent come through referrals of people within the business saying, this is a seriously high-performing place to work, or was there other ways in which you were able to signal that level of high performance?
Yeah. I think referral were actually a big part of our recruitment strategy. We also paid sizable referral bonuses to people when they, when actually their friends or contacts that they had passed probation. So that really helped us to get access to great talent. And, I was never a fan of recruiting agencies because I don't think they're necessarily that interested in bringing you the best culture fit talent. They're just interested in getting their commission. They might not represent your culture anyway that well. Sometimes you have to use them, especially for executive search. We had an in-house recruitment team, and that was also the best way, I think, to getting access to them because they really are able to, represent the business so well to the external world. So I think that was an area attending recruitment events where you, again, can represent yourself in the right lights. I think that was the best way. And of course, because we were an app that was used at the end by over 100 million users, we had also, people that just knew about Boozoo and we were making the news, and that's why we got access to great talent.
Okay. Going back to other elements of the business, you spoke before about how fundraising doesn't equal success and how it's maybe a bit more of a egotistical signal as opposed to the actual signal of a health of a business.
Yeah.
Can you speak a bit more to that? Because you raised very little compared to how much you sold for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, first, I guess we were quite bad at fundraising because we definitely tried, but I probably had over 100 rejections from various VCs as well in terms of fundraising at different times of the journey. But we believe that, you know, we should only raise amounts that bring us to the next level. And interestingly, at the beginning, when we started, we had a couple of hundred thousands of euros available, kind of family money that helped us to kickstart things off. Then we started to monetize relatively early on, at least for these times. So after a year in, we switched gears and created a paid version. It was a freemium model, so already you could, you know, pay for a premium version of Boozo. So we started to generate revenues. And then we kind of learned about the power of performance marketing. And those were different days, but you know, we started to run our first AdWords ads in Google search, paid search ads, and we realized that, you know, we had positive unit economics, so we had a great LTV to CAC, lifetime value to customer acquisition cost ratio. So we put, I don't know, 5k into AdWords and we got 15k back. So then we put 10k into AdWords and we got 20k back, and we started to ramp up our performance marketing spend, and our revenues followed in line, so that I think we were managing to spend over 200,000 euros a month in performance marketing without raising external funds, because we were working capital negative. So we just generated so much revenues, and I still believe the best way of fundraising is actually to generate real revenues as opposed to raising just from investors. So we had just this cash coming in, reinvested in the business, got more cash out, reinvested in the business, and leveled ourselves up to pretty decent multi-million euro revenues without the need of giving away any of the equity. Because that was the other thing, that we were you know, always a bit like suspicious about this need to raise too much, dilute yourself. And in fact, I've met over the years, obviously, lots of founders who, you know, might have had amazing exits on the top line number, but they had a tiny fraction of the pie, you know, like single digit percentages of the equity cap table. And to be honest, if you work like a madman for 15 years, you also want probably to have some sort of financial success of that as well. And it's quite hard to, you know, sell a business in the first place. So if you then only get out with, let's call it a couple of millions that you pay tax on, etc., then maybe it's also not the type of journey that actually rewards the risk that you have taken in the first place. So we're always a bit cautious of like how much equity do we keep. And up until the very end, we kept actually a lot of equity, but also were able to give a lot of equity to the employees. So at the exit, we distributed over 50 million euros among our employees. So there were a lot of smiles at the exit day. And I'm incredibly proud of that. I think it was one of the most successful stock option plans probably in Europe, because it allowed a lot of people to make money, to participate in the success, which is exactly what we're lacking here in Europe. And obviously the US is years ahead, where many, many more people actually did participate in big exits as well. And then they're able to build their own businesses, and the whole ecosystem gets stronger and stronger. So we were able to do that. Hence, we decided not to raise too much. Sometimes we couldn't. Sometimes we decided against. I remember even in 2012 or so, we got a term sheet from a tier one VC. And I think it was a 1 million euro term sheet. And then we presented there and they laughed. And it's like, we love you so much. We not want to give you 1 million. We want to give you 2 million, but the valuation stays the same. And we were like, oh, well, then we're going to dilute ourselves twice as much. So we're not going to take that money. We're just going to continue our own journey. And they couldn't really believe it. I think it was the first time someone had told them that they're not going to take the 2 million euros. And, you know, at that time, it was a big amount of money. It was a very, very renowned VC here in London. But we just like, no, actually, we just, you know, rather be the owner of our own destiny. And that's why we raised very little. We raised also from ultra high net worths that we got to know through Hansi, one of our investor. So we took also, I'd say, private money that came in quite fast, not many strings attached, not any nasty liquidation preferences or any of that. So that up until the very end, you know, we were in control of the business. Because I also think, and now being an investor in VCs myself, I mean, it's a tough game, right? I mean, it's this like, you know, do 10 investments, write off 8, have one fund returner, and then, you know, another one that is kind of doing okay. We didn't want to be necessarily in the batch of just the okay or the whatever shitty companies. And the VC model is based on that. And if you're not that rocket ship, I don't think necessarily you're also going to get that operationally operational insight. In fact, it's another problem of the European ecosystem that I think only a tiny fraction of European VC investors actually have operational startup experience. Most of them are just some, you know, Excel junkies and people with financial backgrounds, which is important and helpful, but not necessarily will tell you how to build a culture-based business, or, you know, how to hire your executive team, or, you know, how to do your go-to-market strategy, because they're lacking that experience themselves. So I think somehow this kind of added value from VCs is a little bit overrated. So we just took private money and then got the insights by getting amazing board advisors on board, for example. So I had Andrew Wade, used to be the president of Lynda.com, which got acquired by LinkedIn. It's now LinkedIn Learning, basically. It was a multi-billion exit. And so I just approached him and asked him to be on our board, and we gave him shares and just built an amazing personal relationship. And he was my mentor. So was Hansi, of course, over many, many years. So I got my insights and inputs from other people that we could just, you know, plug into the system rather than needing to raise from a tier one VC and hope that they will give me good insights. And hopefully, you know, our journeys align with them.
Yeah, because interestingly, the VC timeline is 7 to 10 year exit. Right. And by year seven, you were at the bottom of the trough of sorrow. You were like right down
Absolutely.
The dumps.
Yeah.
And your exit would be an amazing positive to most VCs,
yes.
Pretty much any VC.
Yeah.
But it only happened in the following 8 years, which just doesn't align with the time frame.
Absolutely. I think just in general, we were probably a weird animal, because not only did we as founders have a lot of equity, also my co-founder Adrian, he had a lot of equity, but he actually operationally had left the business, so that was always a bit strange. And then let's face it, we had also a competitor from the US, Duolingo, that came in exactly 7 years after we had launched, and they raised a lot of money. I think they raised about $180 million and gave away the product for free for 7 years. So we were kind of having our little shop trying to sell our premium memberships, while next door we had a bar with, you know, open tap for free for 7 years, which was hard to compete with. And in Europe, at least, no one wanted to give me $180 million to compete with such a big gorilla in the room. So I think people were also a bit reluctant to like put money behind us, seeing that there was a very strong US competitor with an incredibly aggressive go-to-market strategy, which at many years wasn't really clear of how exactly they're gonna ever return that money. They did. But, you know, we found our own way. And therefore, I think also we're quite careful in after the first near blow up of not scaling too fast, keeping our growth under control, keeping our unit economics under control, always being able to get into cash flow break even if we needed to. We raised some venture debt as well. So again, a non-dilutive form of raising money where you just pay interest. That worked out incredibly well. So there's like different forms of fundraising. That doesn't mean that you end up with a tiny slice of the pie, sell maybe at a big number, but actually financially it doesn't really compensate for what you've done.
So when you go into fundraising and you have an amount of money in your mind, like with this tier one VC in London, you had $1 million in your mind.
Yeah.
And then they come back to you and they say $2 million. Now, some entrepreneurs I've spoken with say, take money. You have an extra buffer. It means that, let's say, because you said you only raise until the next milestone.
Yeah, kind of until what we might need to get to the next milestone, right?
Right. And I suppose the question I have is, how many experiments do you give yourself space for within that time frame? Because let's say the next milestone is you hit X number of users, and that's, you assume, is in 18 months.
Yeah.
And you've allowed yourself the space, that time, to have, let's say, three experiments. But then each of those three experiments don't work.
Yeah.
And then you're left at the next 18 months going, shit, I need to either fundraise again or cut half the team. And we haven't grown properly based on what we said we were going to do. And we don't have this extra buffer. How do you then make that decision?
Yeah, but that's why ideally you're also never in the situation where you're just pouring out money constantly. I mean, you need to, I believe, and it's maybe a bit more conservative than what other people have done, but I believe, you know, you need to be able to always be able to pull back and reduce your burn, and ideally never really scale so fast that you're all you know, stand here with tons of people that you don't necessarily need right now, or maybe the revenues don't follow all this ramp up of costs. If you're a bit more cautious and careful about that, then you don't need to raise that much amount of money, unless, of course, I mean, there's different industries and businesses, and you have, you know, now AI platforms raising billions. But again, they know that they need that, and then they will lock off the rest of the market and no one else will be able to enter. It's a different game and times have evolved. But I still believe, especially in the times we are right now, where, you know, fundraising is still complicated, I think we're back to the level of 2014 or 15, especially in edtech, actually, with regards to fundraise. It has completely dried out. Again, as an LP myself into VCs, I see how cautious you are. The bar is so incredibly high in order to raise money these days. So even more so, I think, to create a sustainable business that just maybe burns a little bit rather than having this outflow of money is the right way to do. And then, you know, if you're ready and you say, oh, okay, let's conquer the US, then you can raise money for that. But don't make your entire destiny dependent of the goodwill of venture capitalists.
So then when you have these investors, I'd love to understand your relationship with your board and including your advisors. Hansi said that the Busuu board meetings were one that he looked forward to the most and that most of the board were really excited about. He said you often had them in Madrid and you'd go out for dinner afterwards and it was a very bonding experience. He also said they were very hard because they were 5 hours, which he said he thought was too long for board meetings. And he also mentioned how the board loved and trusted you as the CEO because you were extremely transparent, you're extremely open, and you never held back, or what it felt like to him, you never held back information at all. Can you talk through that process of transparency with your board and your relationship with your investors?
Yeah, absolutely. I obviously always saw them as my trusted sparring partners, mentors, people that know stuff that I don't know, people who are able to provide me with inputs because I'm so in the trenches that I don't see sometimes the bigger picture. And, you know, that's something I learned myself as well, to pull myself out and then trying to get a bit more of perspective. Hence, it's really not beneficial to tell them a story that is not the truth. So I always felt I need to tell them everything. Maybe that's why they were so long, that is happening in the business, the good and the bad or the ugly, to get their feedback and input. And I guess, you know, organizing them in Madrid and then going out for nice dinners afterwards was an additional benefit to it. But I do also think they were quite structured. And now, you know, sitting on other boards and helping other businesses, I mean, maybe because I had this strategy consulting background, I always was quite good in financial modeling. So I built the entire Busuu business plan at start and then luckily could then hand it over to other people who could continue and make it much better. But I was very much in the numbers. And I personally don't trust founders too much who have no idea what's going on in their financial model. Because at least someone in the founding team needs to understand what's the freaking unit economics, payback time, you name it, all the other KPIs that we were looking at. So we had quite a solid data pack that would literally give you the entire overview of how the business is performing. And that was a pre-read and, you know, proper slides and stuff that people I would expect to read beforehand. And then we had a few, I guess, strategic call-out conversations about, you know, going into the US or new product launches or whatever it might be. But I always, at the later stage, then always brought the executive team also to board meetings. I think it's so important to make sure that, you know, they are also part of this journey and you're not the only one carrying that the weight on the shoulder, but rather we are here together as a team. So all of them were able to present their part, get feedback. And, you know, you as a CEO and founder, you're still running the business. So they might have some ideas that, you know, might be helpful or maybe not, but it's an open space to discuss that. And then it's up to you to, and that's also what I always tell my other founders, you know, where I invest, like it's their choice at the end, whether they take my advice or not. But at least I always wanted to hear their opinions. And I think it was a super fruitful and open discussion. Yeah.
Love it. Something I'm very much aligned with as well. Hansi also sung your praises. He just said he's such a great guy, so brilliant, disciplined in his work, extremely intelligent, and now after some years great with people, great speaker with clear messages, he's transparent, open, and listens. He motivates and aligns people around a common goal, which I thought was wonderful. the one thing that he still didn't fully understand about you was in these peak crisis moments, either you had a board meeting or you maybe had an emergency call with the board and you'd present them with the crisis. And Hansi said he remember thinking, whoa, this is going to be hard work. This is on the edge. And he said that you would go to bed on this problem and by the morning you'd come up with a bunch of ideas and you had so much energy and motivation as if you'd started a brand new company. And he was just wondering, how on earth did you do that?
That's great to hear. Fantastic feedback. I mean, I think I switched my chip after the crisis in 2013, 2014. Before, probably, I somehow, maybe that's also being a perfectionist, I always was striving for getting to some sort of perfect outcome, a place where the company is in an amazing position and somehow we are in this like la la land where music plays and, you know, everything is beautiful and we have no troubles anymore. Reality is that place doesn't exist. It will never exist. And it doesn't really matter whether you're 10, 50, 100 or 1,000 people, the problems will always be there. And the essence, the pure essence of entrepreneurship is to constantly overcome challenges. That's just what you do. If you believe that one day these challenges will stop, you're just in the wrong job. So thereby, from a mindset perspective, I stopped to believe that I will ever get to that place, but I rather switched in a way that I said, I'm actually enjoying these overcoming challenges. And, oh, CTO has resigned. Okay, let's find another CTO. Let's maybe get someone who knows different things and we can even upgrade. Or, I don't know, we have here some, whatever, payment issues. Well, let's maybe sort them out and get the infrastructure in a better place. Whatever it might be, nothing, literally nothing could blow me out anymore. I was whatever, and there were so many crazy things. We had once a hacking attack where someone, you know, managed to convince our bank to wire some money to a fraudster, and you know, money was already on the way and we luckily could stop it, and you know, they just engineered some sort of, you know, social scam around me, and we nearly, you know, lost €1 million. You know, I had a lot of things going on. Luckily, you know, never happened and it all came back. Nothing really could shock me anymore because I just, you know, had, I think, found my own balance and calmness. And I realized, you know, and, you know, Ben Horowitz says it very well, in the Hard Things About Hard Things, that you need just to embrace the struggle. Like, don't fight it. You need to embrace it. You need to start enjoying the roller coaster. If you're constantly like, oh no, again, that, no, I mean, you know, then don't go on the roller coaster, you know, just don't go. I mean, I just, you know, found, I think, energy in being able to resolve difficult issues together with an amazing team. That energized the hell out of me. Like, just whatever it might be, I always knew we will come up with a solution. And I had people to rely on. And I just loved seeing them being engaged. And, you know, that really helped me to just keep on going.
Inside your mind, your internal dialogue in these crisis moments, pre the mass resignation period, feeling more stress, I'm assuming your internal monologue is like, this is really hard, this is really stressful, I'm really hoping for this nirvana state at one day when there are no problems. Post that exodus, what does the internal monologue sound like when crisis hits? Mm. When the scammer is there, £1 million is on the way out of the bank accounts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think... you're just, as you say, you're like in crisis mode. And I don't think your brain works in the right way to deal with the crisis. You maybe go back into some sort of, you know, aggressive modes of being, you know, harsh with people or short patient, and you try to resolve it in the old ways. Whereas I think the other state of mind allows you to be just more calm. I guess it's similar to a surgeon in the emergency room. Again, a surgeon in the emergency room who works, you know, night shifts probably does not expect that he just doesn't or she doesn't need to do anything that night. I mean, probably the core expectation is there will be injured people coming in and they need to do something, right? I mean, that is the expectation. And that's why they need the super calm mind to be able to deal with the crisis. And I think that's what allowed me also to understand that that mind is so much better to dealing with problems in the first place, because, and you know, we know it from neuroscience, et cetera. And, you know, we know the benefits of meditation, et cetera, which I then picked up at a certain point. Like, you know, it just allows you to be calm, to assess. Also, because I think I already had this like several near death moments in the past. I wasn't afraid of them anymore. I believed in the overall existence of Boozoo. I believed in like there is a market for online language learning. You know, we are generating revenues. We are close to cash flow break even. Like, it's not going to blow up every time or anytime anymore in that way. You know, we will be successful at a certain point. It's just a question of when, not if. And so therefore, I think I was in a different state of mind. I had, you know, different level of conversations with my team. I relied much more on them rather than constantly trying to have everything on my shoulders. And thereby, I think we were just much more confident ourselves.
And is that level of calmness something you also expected from your leadership team?
Ideally, yes. But of course, you know, people need to go through their own journey. But in general, I think we had an incredibly professional leadership team. And, you know, over the 15 years, I probably had 3 or 4 different leadership teams, because people, you know, get to their own tenure and say, now that's enough. And now I want to do something else than online language learning. And I totally understand that. Not everyone is so obsessed about that, like myself. I was obsessed about it. But yeah, I think that, again, was part of our culture. I mean, be respectful, you know, it doesn't really matter whatever happens. We would never allow any sort of abuse or people being aggressive, because it just doesn't help. You need people who are able to bring people together, to motivate them, to basically get them into the best state of mind themselves so they can resolve the various issues that they have to be working on. And whether that's the junior engineer to the most senior person, all of them ideally are in a state of mind of high performance. And that's, I think, what the expectation was. Hence, there was no shouting or no difficulties in that sense. It was always, I think, a place of respect.
Talking about the struggle, it reminds me of something that you said when we first met, which was everyone views success as the exit.
Mm.
Whereas, as Ben Horowitz talks about in The Hard Thing About Hard Things, success is the struggle.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned before that you have experienced this in your post-exit life.
Mm.
Can you speak a bit more about your evolving definition of success?
Mm. Yeah, I think there is this kind of narrative in the startup ecosystem that the pinnacle of startup success is when you sell the business. But for me, that's like saying the pinnacle of Rafa Nadal's success is when he hands in the records and he retires from tennis. That's not the pinnacle of his success. The pinnacle of his success is when he's, you know, winning the whatever 7th Grand Slam tournament and he prepares for the next one. I mean, that's when he operates or did operate at the absolute top of his game. And therefore, I would say my probably top of the game was the years 2019 to 2022 or something like that, when, you know, we also had the COVID crisis then, where the business started suddenly to accelerate and we had to shift into fully remote and, you know, also sort of challenges that we had. That was when I probably was at my best game as a CEO. Of course, given the fact that you have external investors and they expect, and you have employees who probably also expect some sort of liquidity event at a certain point, somehow you're bound to do something about that. And, you know, once we got this amazing offer and went through the exit process, of course, it was amazing to be able to sell a business for such an amount. I think it's still the largest edtech exit in Europe to date. So that was great, but it also meant that, you know, at a certain point, my time had come, right? And I committed to stay on with the business for a year and a half. I left, and afterwards, it was, I think, for me, also incredibly important to make sure that I hand over the business in a good state.
Sorry, when you say committed to stay in the business for a year and a half, your earnout was longer than a year.
I had a bit longer than that. Yes, exactly. But I decided to then move on after a year and a half, right? Absolutely. Because, you know, I also felt that business is changing. There's a new ownership. And automatically, as soon as you sell, you're handing over the keys. So you don't need to lie to yourself that even though I maintain to be the CEO and, you know, the company who bought us Check, you know, treated us incredibly well. And there were also difficult periods, I would say, because not only did the entire ecosystem change, especially with the Ukrainian war crisis, like inflation, everything suddenly changed, end of COVID period. So, you know, there was a lot of change going on for us as a business, but also Check got disrupted by ChatGPT. I mean, when they bought us and they were worth about $12 billion in market cap. And I think as of now, there was about $200 million of market cap. So there's quite a drastic change in that. So they went through their own challenges. And that's why, you know, for me, it was important to make sure that the team was fine, that we can continue our journey, that we get our business back on the growth track that it wanted it to be. We did a big product change as well, which I, you know, led together with the team. And then it was time for me to move on.
So 15 years, and finally, despite that not being the definition of success, you got to your exit, which was huge, $436 million. M&A processes and acquisition processes are generally much longer than people expect, much more complex. It becomes generally quite a tiresome process for most founders. Would love to hear your experience and journey with your exit process.
Yeah. So probably the first learning really is that an exit process does not start when someone calls you up or you get an email to say, we would like to acquire your business, but rather it's something that probably starts many, many years beforehand, where you actually start to basically build relationships with potential acquirers. You start making sure your house is in order, that, you know, it actually can be acquired. So it's something that, you know, you should never forget as a founder, that this is something you need if you are a venture-backed business or you have, you know, angel money, et cetera, that wants to see a return at a certain point. You need at a certain point to put your business in a place that actually it can be acquired. In our case, we were one of the few industries that were accelerated by COVID. So when COVID hits, you might remember people were either baking bread or learning languages online. So we had a massive boost in our revenues. And that immediately, I think, rang a few bells at various people who realized, oh my God, this is an industry we would love to get access to, because it can really grow even beyond the you know, COVID situation or the lockdown situation, because traditionally, language learning still happened a lot offline, but then without a doubt, COVID accelerated the digital transition. So then more and more people realized, hey, actually, I can do this on a mobile phone. So I'm also going to continue to do that, even though I'm not locked up in my home anymore. And, you know, that's to a certain extent what happened. I was actually approached in spring 21. By one strategic acquirer who had we had known from the past, who told us that they had looked, screened the entire market, and they have looked at all the products, and we were by far the best. And that's why they would like to do a quick and lean acquisition process. And whenever you hear quick and lean from a big corporate, all the alarm bells should probably go on. And in fact, we said, well, actually, we're not necessarily up for sale right now, which is what you probably say, because best businesses are not being sold, they're being bought. But we're happy to entertain that conversation if it turns out to be quick and lean, which it didn't. So we then entered into the diligence process with that particular player. We had at a certain point, I think, over 150 people in the due diligence. We were only about 160 employees, so we had nearly one-on-one coverage, which was absolutely insane. It was a very overblown, I think, process. We got thousands of questions that we had to answer. I mean, they were quite traditional, I guess, in their approach. We passed all the tests and everything with flying colors, but somehow, and that was probably more due to external reasons, that potential acquirer still couldn't get to their conclusion, couldn't make up their mind. We're still pondering about it. And it happened that, you know, they left the exclusivity period, which you normally sign up to, where you can only deal with one party. And as soon as we were no longer under exclusivity, we were able to drum up other potential acquirer, of which we then entered into conversations with Jack, who moved incredibly fast. We knew Jack already for some time, which is why I said the whole process probably starts much earlier. So I had some sort of relationship with them, with their CEO and COO as well. And therefore, they committed to a really lean acquisition process, which they luckily also stuck to. And I think 6 weeks in or so, we were then able to sign the deal and then close it a couple of weeks afterwards. But it was an incredible intense period. It also means that you as a founder, you're kind of locked up in a dark room and have to work probably 12, 14 hours a day sometimes. So I was only doing due diligence. None of my team other than the executive team knew about that. So we also had to, you know, shield myself off. I hired a COO before the transaction that really helped me to free myself up from the operational responsibilities so he could really take care of the day-to-day operations, because I was totally out. Together with my CFO and a couple of other core team members, we were only doing due diligence for then probably 6 months, roughly. It was also quite a challenge, I'd say, to sell a Spanish holding company to a US Inc. If you ever had been in touch with the Spanish notary system, you know what I'm talking about. Like, it's incredibly complex. We had also obviously 100 plus employee stock option holders that we had to find and make sure that they had signed the right papers. We had shareholders from a company that we acquired, but we had no idea where they actually were. So we had to chase up all of them to make sure they signed the right power of attorneys. You know, to wire and distribute that amount of money and make sure it hits into the right bank accounts. At the closing was a whole logistical nightmare. So, you know, there were so many crazy moments where I also felt like it's probably going to fall apart, that, it was lucky that it actually didn't. But probably with hindsight, because I had seen a few fundraisings actually in the past fell off beforehand, we had, you know, some of the fundraisings from the past being pulled off like a couple of weeks before closing. There are all sorts of things happening. In that transaction, I went into with the mindset, if it doesn't happen, it doesn't matter. You know, I'm still fine. We still have an amazing business. We have an incredible team. Someone will buy this business at a certain point. I'm not too worried about. So that was the right attitude. Not this like, oh my God, I need to sell this. You know, if I don't sell and look, all this money, it's going to come. And if I don't do it, it's going to be a failure. That would have been a disaster. We were totally cool. We worked our asses off, but we were able to remain calm until the very end. And whatever crazy, whatever legal hurdle that was being thrown into our way, we could resolve it in a calm way. And then until at a certain point, money hit the bank.
Wow. What is like a bloat? What's a bloated due diligence process when it comes to a sale? Because obviously you went through this incredibly detailed process with your first potential strategic acquirer and you'd answered all of those questions.
Yeah.
And so then when you went to chat with Chegg, you'd be like, well, we've answered all these questions. Here's the stack of papers with all the answers.
Yeah.
But when you boil it down, what are the important things that a potential acquirer needs to know? I'm guessing it's the same that an investor would need to know. It's just the core fundamentals of the business.
Yeah, you would think so. But of course, that's where I think companies differ, of like how much risk taking are they and how much do they need to kind of tick boxes to cover their asses for potential issues in the future. And I do fully appreciate it. It's a lot of money. So if you're an employee in a strategic acquirer and you're in charge of finance, you want to make sure that all the books and everything is squared up and you have all the audits. I mean, that's the easy part. I mean, that we had, of course, but even on the technical side, you know, all the compliance on GDPR and whatever data privacy topics, if we had users in China and how compliant they were with local regulations. And I mean, the list goes on and on. And there's an entire industry of people you can hire to do all this due diligence. So we had several consultancies, you know, big names that were looking into all of the different various angles. We had a B2C business, we had a B2B business. I mean, there's a whole range. So again, it depends how entrepreneurial are you in these decisions. And, you know, those were also listed companies. So I do understand that they have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that they don't buy some crap that then explodes in their faces in the future. But we also knew that our business is in a really good shape. That's why also, ideally, you know, make sure your books are in order and the tech works and it's all compliant. Probably years. I mean, you should do that anyway, but to make sure everything is documented and so on, you probably start years before you even think about, you know, selling the business, because just something that isn't right might blow up in the face. I mean, literally every day. And that was kind of the attitude. I always felt like, you know, maybe just there's just one thing that might not work for them, and then the whole transaction will disappear and all the time you've spent will be gone. But that's okay, because I know I have a great business and at a certain point someone will be interested for it. But yeah, I think it was a bit overblown. I think it's also that particular company probably hasn't acquired that many companies at that size, whereas Jack was in general a very acquisitive company. So they had a lot of experience, they had a fantastic M&A team. And I think it's also important to keep your lawyers at bay, because when it turns into an ego fight among the legal teams, then you might be screwed as well, because ideally you're still the principal. Well, you are the principal and you're hopefully making the right calls of like, what are you willing to accept and what not, because it's a negotiation until the very end. So I think, and that happened to me in the past with you know, either people wanting to acquire us or people investing, that sometimes even, you know, the legal arguments become so big that then people say, well, okay, well, we're not going to invest or we're not going to acquire the business. And that's sometimes only because you had a very aggressive lawyer or they had a very aggressive lawyer that is just want to be right rather than want to get the deal done. So I think it's also super important to have a legal team in place that is commercial, that actually wants to get the deal done rather to argue 4 hours about the comma and the dots in the 300-page SPA that you're going to sign.
Wow, the nuances. But hey, the struggle is the success. It's the journey, right?
Right, exactly.
Wow, this has been incredible. The threads that I recognize throughout all the different elements of the story is build a great business from the ground up.
Yeah, I think it's helpful.
That's pretty simple, right? And build a culture first business and then keep your calm.
I would probably start with the culture first, because if you have the right culture, you're going to build an amazing business. Mm. If you are from a culture obsessed about your customer, if you want to do things right, if you want to have a great product, et cetera, then the great business will come out as a consequence. And then the calmness, I think you probably get after the years, after you've seen a few and survived a few battles, and realizing that because you have an amazing culture, because you will always be able to create a great business, there's no need to stress out. It will be successful at a certain point.
And how has post-exit life been?
quite different. I'd say, you know, it's very, very different to go from a very busy CEO, co-founder lifestyle where your entire agenda is booked to, you know, now a time where I have complete freedom of what I do with my time. At the moment, I spend a lot of time with my kids because, you know, they're currently at an age, they're 8 and 11 years old, where, you know, I truly enjoy being with them. And let's face it, before as a father, I was not always that present because, especially pre-COVID, I was in the office working hard. So I'm kind of trying to make sure that now when I have the time, I can spend time with them. I probably did the mistake of investing in too many other startups and realized for myself that being a full business angel is not necessarily my passion. I do other things. I get involved in philanthropy, for example. I you know, sometimes have speaking events or doing podcasts, sharing some of the knowledge. I also travel a bit, just coming back from a trip to Japan. I basically enjoy life as well. So I spend time with the kids and I you know, do my own things to keep myself active. But I deliberately taking a bit of a downtime. And I have to say, I really enjoy it. Like, I'm young enough to be able to build several businesses in the future. I don't financially have to do that necessarily again. I think it would be a bit madness right now to jump immediately back into it and then build my own next hamster wheel, where right now actually I have the liberty to do whatever I want. And I enjoy that. Once the kids are a little bit older, I'm pretty sure at a certain point it's no longer so cool to hang out with daddy. And then I might do something again. And for sure, I think it's going to be an impact-driven business. I think life's too short for me to, I don't know, build something that doesn't have a positive impact in the world, which for sure we had at Boozoo, where we allowed people to learn other languages and, you know, connect each other. So it's something that I'm passionate about. I do a lot in the climate space at the moment. So there's different things I'm looking at, but I'm resisting the urge to jump back in straight away. I'll give myself my time and let's see.
For someone who still has quite a few, it's earlier on in my journey, but also don't yet have kids, but very excited to have a family at some point. Mm. And I can very much see a future where I'm building or in the middle of building when I start a family. Mm. How would you manage that work-life harmony if you would do it differently at all? If you were to wind back the clock and you're in my shoes, what's some advice that I can take on to think about the harmony between the two?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure there will be harmony necessarily in that case, because let's say if you prioritize time with the kids and you want to be at the school gate at 3 p.m., which I can be right now, and that's what I do, you will probably miss to be in the office as well and to get shit done for your business. So I think it's very hard to combine the both. Luckily, I had a supportive wife at the time who were taking care of the kids. And I tried to be there as much as I could over the weekends and on holidays. But of course, you know, I missed out on things. But that was the trade-off that I consciously took, because I was also incredibly passionate about the other baby that I had, which was Boozoo. And I just felt I wanted to do this journey. And I knew also that if it's successful, which it luckily became, I will be able to financially allow my family a certain way of living, give them freedom, be able to, you know, pay for education, whatever it might be, that will hopefully they will recognize and be grateful for in the future. And then, you know, now, as they're still young, I can spend a lot of time with them that other people can't because they need to go to the office. So it worked out for me, I would say, but it's very hard. And, you know, I have huge respect for, you know, female founders as well, who have to juggle also, you know, the whole pregnancy, giving birth, being with the kids in the first couple of months, etc., and running a business. It's incredibly hard. So it's, you know, difficult to combine the two. If you try to be perfect at the two, you will fail. So you have to make your choice. And I think overall, I made the right choices. And now it allows me to have a lot of freedom.
And when you had, I'm guessing you had this sort of style of conversation with your wife at the time. Was she very aware and supportive of that priority of your time and that chain of logic? Or was that a point of tension?
Yes, but of course, it's always a bit of a, I think, source of friction as well. Because, you know, let's face it, no party loves just to be the only one at home doing nappy change, where the other one is traveling to San Francisco and trying to fundraise or doing whatever it might be. So yeah, it is friction. You know, at a certain point, we also had a bit of help, etc. But yeah, you need definitely a supportive partner. You know, she's also a lawyer. She was busy then in her own job. So at a certain age, it's less of an issue if the kids go to kindergarten or school. But yeah, it's difficult. So I don't know, for example, how it would work if both were to run a business. That I think for sure is complicated. But, you know, people need to work it out. And I had my, you know, priorities clear at that time. I knew I want to be with them whenever I can. And I think, you know, even in the early days, I was a great father. I also knew I want to focus on the business to make sure it's successful. And I also knew if I'm able to achieve that, I will be able to spend so much more time with them and allow them all sorts of things that otherwise I would not be if I didn't have a business. So overall, I think it worked out.
Gotta enjoy the struggle.
Yes.
Coming into the end and thinking about the point in time when you decide to try something next.
Mm.
You mentioned a Mark Twain quote elsewhere that you love, which was, they didn't know it was impossible, so they did it.
Yeah.
This is a mindset that I suppose more naive early stage founders go into a business with, and therefore they will bite off a big problem. And if most people knew how hard it was to start something or run something like that, then they maybe wouldn't have done it in the past. Now that you're going into a second business, you don't have that same level of naivety anymore. How does that change? Or maybe you do. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
how does
that
change?
I think that quote relates to the naivety about the difficulty of the journey, which I think I now know about. So that's why, you know, I'm very cautious about not jumping into it straight away, because I know how hard it's going to be in any case. And that's, again, might be another 10 to 15 years commitment. So that's why I'm very aware of that. But that quote also relates to naivety about the industry you're going into. So I wasn't a linguist, nor was Adrian. Like, we had no idea about language learning other than that I had learned 4 languages myself. That was it. And then I knew how to do, I don't know, PowerPoints and Excel sheets from strategy consulting, and that helped me to draw the wireframes of Boozoo. So I had, I think, quite a good eye for, you know, how information should flow and how screens should look like and organization of information, etc. But we had no idea about, let's say, language learning. And at that time, people told us it's impossible to learn language online. Whereas right now, these days, of course, a lot of people learn languages online. But also in the businesses that I invest in, there's very few, and maybe it's even a bad sign if people necessarily come from the industry they're trying to disrupt. I think the naivety also allows you to have a totally neutral perspective on things, because I think the sentence of "it always has been done like that" is the first way of decline of an organization, right? So actually, it doesn't really matter whatever had been done so far. You might be able to do it in a completely new way. And that, I think, is super important. So yeah, I mean, most likely, if I go back into building a business, it will be in an industry I have no clue about. You can then always hire subject matter experts. We had an amazing education team of linguists at the later point, who obviously would write the grammar units and explain all sorts of, you know, different structures of language. At the beginning, I was doing that, the first version of it. But then, of course, we realized you need to hire some people with subject matter expertise. But disrupting an industry does not require that knowledge of the industry as such. I think it's a benefit if you have no idea of how things are done, because it allows you to have a totally fresh perspective and to come in from a different angle that no one had expected before.
Mm. I also see this or have heard this same reasoning applied to men starting femtech companies.
Mm.
So if you are not the customer and you don't therefore have your own personal experience of the problem, you have to obsess over the customer and their experience of the problem, because
Absolutely.
You can't assume that you have any experience of the problem.
Yeah, I think passion and obsession about the customer and their problems is absolutely essential. Like, if you don't have the passion to resolve the problem you're going out for to resolve, you're not going to succeed. You're going to give up throughout the challenge. You need to, and I mean, I still love learning languages, and I still, you know, I just, it's such a beautiful industry that allows, as said, like, people to connect, to learn about other cultures. It enriches people's lives so much that I would never get tired of that. I think you need to have that. If you just say, look, you know, maybe there's some sort of, I don't know, insurance problem, and I might build like an insure tech company, but actually you don't care about insurances, then it's most likely not going to be successful, because the journey is going to be so hard that unless you just burn for it internally, you're going to give up. And I think that is absolutely essential. It doesn't mean that you are the absolute expert in it, but you need to just deeply care about the problem and the customer. And that fire needs to be able to withhold for tens of years. Otherwise, don't even start it.
Okay, last two questions. The first is, I'd love to get a quick fire idea. Stealing from Peter Thiel, is there an unconventional perspective that you hold that most people disagree with you on?
Yeah, I think maybe what we discussed before about diversity being mistaken for being diverse in culture. So I do believe it's incredibly important and essential these days to have a very diverse team in terms of gender, religion, background, you name it. But it doesn't mean that you need to be diverse on values and certain behaviors. I think there you need to be incredibly aligned and you need to create a certain way of operating as discussed before. And then the diversity in the other areas comes on top as a benefit. But don't just optimize for diverse without alignment on culture.
Mm. Yeah, so powerful. Last question I ask all of my guests is, assuming this has been listened to or is being listened to by hundreds, if not thousands, of entrepreneurs, and as a thank you for you coming in, sharing your experiences and giving your time, is there anything that a community of entrepreneurs could support you on?
Yes. I mean, as I said, I don't want to jump into the next thing too early because I, you know, could see myself working with a younger founder that potentially doesn't have yet the operational experience to, you know, scale a business in the way that I have done. And potentially I would be interested, especially if it's an impact or only if it's an impact driven organization, to support someone like that, whether it's with financial support or as advisory. So if there is of your audience, people out there who are currently sitting somewhere in a lab and building something around climate change, for example, but don't know yet how to, I don't know, write a business plan, do a financial model, and they can maybe hit me up or ping me, because at a certain point, I most likely will go back into the race and I'm definitely keen to meet interesting people in this space.
Where's the best place people can reach out to you?
I'd say probably LinkedIn, although I definitely have to clean up my inbox at a certain point. But yes, give it a try on LinkedIn. And if you're persistent enough, you're going to reach me.
Amazing. Thank you so much. That's been incredible.
Thank you. It was amazing.